This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the president of Planes of Fame about the museum, restoring warbirds and historic aircraft, and flying heritage flights. In the news, we look at the world's largest jet engine, restraints on open-door helicopter flights, United Airlines and dogs, facial scanning at airports, the Boeing 737 MAX 7 first flight, hacking the aviation industry, and GPS vulnerabilities. All that and a lot more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 495 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Max. Hi, everyone. Looking forward to a great show this evening.
Also, here is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max T., how are you?
Seriously. Absolutely seriously. just came back from flying, in fact. Just barely made it here, so happy to be here this week.
Good. We're glad to have you. And also joining us after a few weeks' absence is Rob Mark, senior editor at Flying Magazine and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob, good to hear your voice again.
Hey, it's nice to be back. And like Max T., I was out flying, and I just made it back in time as well. And because it was very windy here, I haven't done a gusting to 29 knots landing in quite a while. It was exciting, Max.
It was exciting. Is that is that an understatement, or was it as well executed as that?
Hopefully it's not an underwear statement. That's the key.
Yes, that's true. You know, one of those things where you're sure you're right there, the runway's right there, and all of a sudden, whoa, it's a little higher than you thought, and now you're back flying with no airspeed. It's really fun.
All right. Well, David Vanderhoof is off this week. He's still suffering from the flu. I hope he gets lots of rest and comes back and joins us again next week. Our guest this episode is Steve Hinton. He's president of Planes of Fame Air Museum. He's an aviator who held a world speed record from 1979 to 1989. He also won six unlimited class air races, including two national championships. Now, Steve retired from racing in 1990, but he was honored in 2016 with the Crystal Eagle Award from the Aero Club of Northern California. Steve, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed being asked. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. And coming up, we'll be talking with Steve about what's new at the museum and this year's air show and even flying at the Super Bowl. But first, we're going to start off with some aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
Oh, yeah.
Ready, ready from the West.
Our first story comes from Reuters. GE starts flight trials of world's largest jet engine. Well, on March 13th, GE flew the new GE9X engine. It was mounted to the company's 747 testbed aircraft and flew for more than 4 hours. Now, this is the engine that's intended for the Boeing 777X, which has a scheduled entry into service in 2020. First flight is scheduled for first quarter next year, 2019. And General Electric had expected to start flight trials in December, but they announced they'd found a technical problem with the engine and the test plane. And a little engine glitch requiring the redesign of a part in the compressor, although I'm not sure which part that is. But this is one large engine. It's in the 100,000-pound thrust class. It has a huge diameter fan, 134-inch fan. That gives it the honor of being the largest jet engine. So just by way of comparison, 134-inch for the 9X, the GE9X. The GE90, from which it's derived, has, well, I think 123-inch and 128-inch fans. The Trent 1000 has a 110-inch fan. The old Pratt & Whitney PW4000 engines that first powered the early 747s, just a 94-inch fan. In terms of some of the newer engines on smaller aircraft, the LEAP 1A on the A320neo has a 78-inch fan. The PW1100G, the geared turbofan engine on the same, on the A320neo, has an 81-inch fan. And the C-Series has a 73-inch fan.
And Max, that one bolted to the wing of the 747. It looked almost like they needed to shave off the bottom of the engine for clearance, like the engine on the 737. The thing is so incredibly big. So I actually had a question for either Max T or Rob. In having an engine that big sitting on one side of the aircraft, do they put an awful lot of fuel in the other wing in order to counterbalance that? Or how do they deal with such a huge difference?
Well, they would have to come up with some way to balance it, because I don't know what the exact weight is on the standard engine. But as you said, this one is much larger. But again, you know, I mean, let's even say it weighed 5,000 pounds more than the original. That's still significant enough that it, if you don't do something, you're going to have some control issues there. But I think what I was wondering too, and I didn't see the answer to this, I would assume it must have been running on takeoff, because normally the 7.4 has four motors to get up in the air. And or did they do a three-engine takeoff and start that thing once it was in the air? Readers want to know.
Good question. I would assume that they use the engine during the takeoff, because that, well, that's a good question. You know, was that part of the test? Probably it was.
Yeah, but looking at the video, it looked like it was spinning. So I'd say it was powered on.
Once the air starts flying past the fan, it's gonna spin.
You'd get some windmilling, yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily mean it's producing anything. I guess
if you look
it's
at
really
the photograph,
kind of
you could probably tell by the heat coming out the tail. You know, if the photograph shows the heat out the tail, you'll know if it was idling or if it was producing power.
Right. So I guess we'll have to take another look at the videos and see if we can answer that question. But
yeah, because what you can do is that if you take a look at the tailpipe, if you see any heat coming out the back, then you know it's probably running. That was my thought.
Yes, yes.
Oh, did somebody else already? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I tried.
You tried.
Hey, Steve, we do whatever we can to make points.
Well, that's good. You guys do a good job.
Thanks. But Brian, you know, on to answer your question, or at least kind of address it, many, many years ago, I was on the original, the first Boeing 777 test aircraft, and the interior was fitted with big tanks, water tanks for ballast. So they could actually pump the water around to these different tanks in order to simulate different conditions, different loadings, different you know, fore and aft weight distributions and things like that. So most likely this, I don't know for a fact, but most likely this 747 test bed has that kind of capability, so that they can balance it and test different kinds of, you know, different balance situations.
Yeah, maybe if the core is the same weight and the rest is just air for the giant fans, it doesn't weigh that much more. I don't know.
Just a quick look at the order book for the 777X shows that Emirates has far and away the most of these on order between the -8 and the -9. They have 150 on order, and that's followed by Qatar with 60. Then you have Etihad with 25, Cathay Pacific with 21, and Singapore Airlines with 20. So all totaled, there are 326 firm orders for the 777X. So, you know, we're early in this test regime. So as we've seen with many other new aircraft, more likely than not, something will come up and require the folks either at Boeing with the aircraft or with the engines to make some adjustments. Hopefully nothing major will come out. Next item, this comes from Washington Post. Chopper flights with open doors, tight restraints grounded. And I think Max Trescott, probably most people have seen in the news this really terrible situation with this open-door helicopter flight that encountered some kind of a problem and went down in the river.
Yes, and we didn't talk about it initially because we don't generally report crashes. And initially, as I looked at it, it just seemed like yet another crash. But there was something really unique about this that has spurred the FAA to come out with a temporary nationwide ban on open door flights with tight seat restraints that could trap people during emergencies. And essentially what this company and I guess other companies have been doing is offering open door flights with the benefit being that you can get really excellent photography. The company that had organized this photo flight advertises its trip as a chance to take a shoe selfie, and they show a picture of Manhattan with your sneakers sitting in straddling the view of Manhattan. So literally the doors are open, your feet are kind of out there in space. But the only way they've done this in the past is by putting an additional restraint on in addition to the seatbelt. Now, Paul Bergrelli had just an excellent article over the weekend on avweb.com that talked about it. And he said that essentially they have used what he called a screw-type carbineer. I can't say it.
Carabiner.
You know what I mean? Thank you. You can tell I'm not a rock climber. But the screw-type carabiner, you end up imagine you have this tether that goes to your back, and it's attached by a single point, which is a screw-type carabiner, behind you. And that's the only way to free yourself. And so in order to get out, passengers are shown a safety briefing video, and they're equipped with a knife, like a web cutter type, to free themselves in an emergency. Well, in this particular case, apparently they believe that a passenger accidentally bumped the emergency fuel shutoff line, perhaps with a piece of baggage that caused the aircraft to lose power and go down. The video shows it hitting the water, to me, a little hard, which makes me think perhaps they may have misjudged their height above the water. And it's possible that burst one of the flotation bags, because when you look at the picture of the aircraft being extracted from the water, one of the bags does look less inflated than the others. Anyway, the aircraft rolled over on its side, filled up with water. The pilot escaped. All five passengers died. And when the fire department went down to remove them, they had to cut these passengers out from the harnesses to get them free, because none of these people was able to reach back behind them, unscrew the portion of the carabiner that's necessary before you then push it to open it up. So a disaster just waiting to happen. So the FAA has now banned this type of operation. They're now requiring restraints that can be opened with a single action. And so really quite a tragedy.
Hmm. Well, and I think what's also interesting about this is that, I mean, I hate to throw around a stupid phrase like common sense, but you would think that at some point in time, someone that is running a business that is making money out of carrying people would have said, yeah, we can do this. I don't know where we're going to put the knives. Think about that. We don't know where those knives were that were supposed to, and that was going to be the way to get out of it, not to try to unbuckle, but to just cut the harness. So where are we going to put these knives that we don't cause more damage to somebody in an emergency? But does anybody really think that if a copter goes in the water and flips upside down, that all of the people in the back are going to say, oh, yes, this is just what they briefed me about. Now, let me grab my knife and I will cut myself loose and certainly help any of those people around. I mean, it's just the most insane kind of logic you ever heard in your life. But that's essentially what was going on.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really thought about the what if. What if it hit the water? What if the skid floats didn't inflate properly? According to Paul, these kind of landings, helicopters, turn over almost immediately. And I hadn't thought about this. You got a very high center of gravity up there by the rotor. And so that high center of gravity is going to flip you upside down. So you've got open doors, so the helicopter is going to fill with water instantly. The water was about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, can you imagine the kind of the gasping and kind of the initial reaction of being hit by that water? So these people, I think, had absolutely no chance whatsoever.
But doesn't it make you wonder, Max, and maybe you too, Steve, because you're a pilot, that the copter pilot got out of his 5-point in lickety split. But I'm just curious, did anybody read anything about the guy trying to get back under the helicopter to free any of those people?
No, I haven't seen anything about that.
I don't know much about it. Yeah, you know, one thing I'd be concerned about with open doors is shoes and things coming out going into the tail rotor too. That's another interesting.
Oh yeah, you know, that's a good one.
That's like really bad, you know. Yeah, jackets or any of that kind of stuff. So they obviously there's a lot of briefing involved with an operation like that.
Hmm. Yeah, that would be like shooting yourself down, I guess, to have something go into the tail rotor.
It's happened before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have friends that live on the East Coast, and I asked them, because it's received a lot more news coverage there than it has out here on the West Coast, about any follow-up over that or what the pilot of the helicopter did afterwards. And no one said that they've heard anything about that. So it just hasn't been reported if he did try anything.
Yeah, just remember, a helicopter is pretty violent when it hits the water. You've got that rotor blade thrashing around when it hits the water, too. So, I mean, it's, you know, just getting out of one of those things or when they hit the water with it, you know, if it's upright is one thing, but when it lays over, you know, I'm sure the thing wants to destroy itself immediately.
Yeah. Not a good situation.
Yeah. That's too bad.
Yeah. I have a feeling that this will, when it's all said and done and the investigation is complete, we'll see some changes, and we'll probably look back and say, why didn't we do that from the start? You know, it seems so obvious, but sometimes these things that are obvious don't enter into our thinking until, well, the unthinkable happens, and maybe that's what happened here. All right. Well, moving on, we have United Airlines that just can't seem to get a break. Brian, we keep having these dog-related incidents with United Airlines, but in and amongst all of the bad news, there was kind of a nice touch to one of these stories, wasn't there?
What, that the person got a dog upgrade and they got a Great Dane instead of the German Shepherd that they checked in?
Or was it the fact that people made jokes like United is going to the dogs?
That's why I put this news story in, so you could make that joke.
I'm glad I didn't.
Or what about the bill that's been introduced in Congress, which is called WOOF?
No, it is?
You haven't heard about that.
No. Well, I knew there was a bill introduced, but I didn't know what the acronym was.
Yeah, it's like WOOFF or something like that.
Oh.
And do you know what the WOOF stands for? Because I saw that, but I didn't.
I can't remember it.
Yeah.
But it was kind of interesting because a lot of people said, gosh, you know, the Congress is moving really fast to solve a problem related to dogs, but they move really slowly on other problems related to people that seemingly are, you know, more important.
Well, that's because they've been hearing from their constituents and they're tired of those people barking at them.
Oh, wow, this keeps going, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Steve, I'm sorry. I can't help myself sometimes.
I thought the solution to this problem was really good, though, in that United chartered a plane to get the German Shepherd back home. I think they tried to avert some of the negative publicity that they'd been creating for themselves, especially with the other dog story of where they where a passenger put a dog in the overhead bin and the dog ended up expiring as a result of being in the overhead bin. But trying to get ahead of this, chartering a plane was nice. And I think for the dog's sake, it was really nice that they did that as well, because just imagine spending, 11, 12 hours in the cargo hold and then having to turn around and go right back in the cargo hold again. That wouldn't have been very fun. So being around with, I think, some people in a private jet was a nice way to treat the dog.
You wouldn't survive the cargo hold again. So probably good call. You don't want two dead dogs in the same week.
To me, it sounds like somebody pretty high up in United said, I don't care, you know, what it's going to cost, but let's do this. Get a private jet, charter a jet, get the dog, get the animal back to its owners, and in a way that, you know, minimizes any chance of anything disastrous happening. And so it probably cost them a lot of money to do this, but I think that it was the right thing for them to do
until the next event occurs.
Yeah,
but probably cost them a lot of money. I'm certain it cost them a lot of money.
Oh yeah, Now, we were emailing among ourselves last week about this story as it emerged. And Rob, you found a third United Dog incident in the same week?
I can't remember if I thought it might have been, but I was just looking to try to confirm that. And I may have gotten my United Dog issues confused. You know how it is. It does happen when I'm talking United.
Okay.
Well, but the three instances are the dog that died in the overhead bin, the Great Dane going to the wrong destination, and the German Shepherd going to the wrong destination.
You know, you might be right. That might
so
be
that
what
is
I was
three
thinking of.
Dog stories.
Though the two dogs got switched, so that might be the same story. My recollection is I heard that they were they crossed paths in Denver where they were taken to an outside vendor who has a kennel who walked them, took them outside their kennels, and then put them back in the wrong kennels. And so United, of course, looked at the labeling on the kennel and said, oh, this dog goes to Japan. But, of course, it was the kennel that was supposed to go to Japan, not the dog that was in the kennel.
That's crazy. I just heard a news story yesterday driving home of a comfort duck. A passenger had a comfort duck. And, you know, then I heard there was a comfort peacock, but that one got refused.
Right, it did.
With people coming up with these different animals, it's pretty interesting. Isn't it? Crazy times we live in.
Yes, for sure. Another item. This comes from NPR. Facial scanning now arriving at U.S. airports. And NPR says that Customs and Border Protection is testing biometric scanning at a dozen or so U.S. international airports to ensure that people leaving the country are who they say they are and to prevent visa overstays. So the way this works is that there are cameras placed at the gate, takes the passenger photo. It's sent to CBP, Customs and Border Protection. They check to make sure that the person in the photo is booked on the manifest and also that it matches the photo that they already have on file. And then if that's all a match, the door's open and the passenger is allowed to board. If that doesn't happen, if there's not a match, then the traveler's passport is scanned by a gate agent in a manual process. So there are some criticisms out there. One is of possible bias. Some people are wondering if the accuracy of this process varies depending on your race or your gender. There's questions about things like wearing hats and glasses and scarves have an impact on this. And there's just sort of a general privacy protection concern. So what do you guys think? Is this a good idea, something to be concerned about? Or, you know, is this just the way life is these days? Rob, what do you think?
I think it's probably coming. I'm not really terribly surprised that they were testing it. Obviously, the fact that it works better on Caucasian people than it does people of color means they've got a little work to do yet.
Yeah, but here's something. Why are they checking people leaving the country? Don't you want them to leave if they're bad hombres? Whereas, wouldn't you want to check them coming into the country and have that be your first priority as you go to check out this technology and make sure that it's working?
Well, my guess is they're doing
building the database is what it's about. You know that the more you do it, the more it, you know, gets used and they can figure it out. I was driving to El Centro to pick up an airplane this weekend, and right on the highway, when you go by Border Patrol there's a cluster of cameras. So I know that's what they're doing. They're just building databases up, I guess.
Hmm. Yeah, they say that privacy is dead. At least some people do.
Oh, talk to Facebook about that this week. I mean, you're getting their head handed to them.
All right, we should mention that another first flight this week, this past week, the new 737 MAX 7. That's the smallest member of the Boeing 737 MAX family, and it flew just a few days ago on March 17th. For just a little over 3 hours, this launches the flight test program. Boeing noted that the 737 MAX family uses the latest CFM International LEAP 1B engines, as well as their advanced technology winglets, the Boeing Sky interior, and also large flight deck displays and some other features. So, you know, all these first flights, you never really hear anything negative from anybody about them. Maybe it's because the expectation isn't necessarily that everything's going to go perfectly. But in this case, you know, same feedback from the pilots, the test pilots, and Boeing is that everything seemed to work well.
Well, what they mean by first flight is this is the first one that actually got off the ground. They don't tell you about the prior ones where maybe they tried to get it off the ground.
Yeah. Good point.
Now, I think what's interesting with this baby Boeing 737 is the maximum capacity is 172 passengers, which
Great.
Is a really tight fit for all those people if the airlines implement max capacity configuration. So although it really is the smallest by what linear foot of the aircraft, it's still can really pack in an awful lot of high density passengers or passengers in high density. Yeah.
And I'm not sure I want to be on an airplane with 172 maxes. I don't know about you guys.
This also has the longest range of any in the MAX family, 3,850 nautical miles. And Boeing likes to say that it flies farther and can carry more passengers than the competing Airbus A319. But we don't have a lot of orders, a whole ton of orders. We've talked about in the past, Southwest Airlines has ordered some. WestJet has 8 customers in total. There are, as I like to point out, there are a large number of 737-700s as well as Airbus A319s that will eventually come up for retirement. And so maybe that's the market that Boeing is looking for with this aircraft.
I don't know. If I had a choice of having hourly service Los Angeles to New York and flying on the MAX 7 versus having a choice of flying every 3 hours on a larger aircraft, I think I'd really prefer to sit on the ground a little bit longer and be in a larger aircraft.
Except when it comes to boarding and disembarking. I mean, does it take longer to load these big? Well, maybe they use multiple entrances.
But still, it can take quite a while.
Did you guys see there was another story out about 737s this past week? Apparently, they hit a milestone in terms of deliveries.
Yeah.
I saw two numbers in the story. One said 10,000 aircraft, which I guess makes it one of the most numerous airliners ever sold before. The other number was 14,000, and they didn't do a good job of explaining one number versus the other. Did you see anything about that?
Yeah, I thought it was 10,000 was the...
Yeah, that's the only number I saw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, I had no idea they made that many. That's crazy.
That's a huge number. It really is.
That's a
so they delivered 10,000 airplanes in 1 week?
No.
That's it? Yeah.
Those Boeing people.
They kits,
All to Chicago, Rob. They're all coming your way right now.
Oh, goody.
And that's why we need more pilots.
Right. Yeah.
Max, I just found it. They have orders for 14,000.
There you go.
They've delivered 10,000.
That explains it. The article I saw didn't explain the two numbers very well, and so that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's quite a backlog. That says they've got 4,000 orders on the books?
Yep, yep.
That's what they're saying.
That must stretch out, what, 20 years, 15 years?
A long time.
I mean,
a long time. And Airbus, the same with the A320 family. There are just thousands and thousands of these in the backlog. Which is why, I think just about everybody has ordered planes that is intending to order planes. So when people talk about this year's orders versus last year's orders and that sort of thing, I think it's a bad comparison because, there's no one left to order any more planes and there's no more capacity to build any more planes. So you really don't want to see any more orders.
Right. Well, all this is built on, projections forward of current circumstances, and all it's going to take is one little bump in the economy, and poof, a lot of those orders aren't going to be needed. So,
or a big bump, but hey, we should mention also that there are a lot of stories in the press about Russian cyber activity targeting U.S. facilities, and they mention typically in these articles energy sector, nuclear commercial facilities, water. Critical manufacturing sectors, but also aviation shows up in that list as well. And we have an article from Bloomberg, Russian hackers attacked U.S. aviation as part of breaches. And this says that Hackers were attempting to penetrate the U.S. civil aviation industry early in 2017. Now, no one is saying, at least that I've seen, just exactly what the attempted penetration was. But the executive director of the Aviation Information Sharing and Analysis Center, Jeff Troy, which is sometimes called ISAC or AISAC, he said the attack had limited impact and also that the industry has taken steps to prevent a repeat of this intrusion. Now, there's a report, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes as well, from U.S. CERT that tracks these kinds of things. There's a lot of painful detail about some of the attempted penetrations. And they mention that a lot of these come at smaller, more vulnerable businesses that are in the business, and kind of work their way through those. So there's a lot, if you're really into this stuff, there's a lot of detail, but about how the apparent hackers were attempting to do this, but not anything really specific about how that was directed towards aviation.
I just realized that, you know, but I'm sure you do, but, you know, every corporate jet, every airliner is data linked every second the engines are running.
Yes.
So that data is going back and forth between, you know, the observation, the company that's doing the observation and collecting the information. So if there's data moving, you know, then it could be hacked, you know. So that's I'm sure they know that better than any of us, but, you know, I'm sure they're making steps to protect that. But it's, you know, we're finding out, if you can think about it, it can happen. And that seems to be what's going on.
When I saw the story, I kept thinking initially that they were talking about air traffic control hacking. But I ran across one article that referenced Boeing and Lockheed. I just did a quick search. There were articles out in February that said this group had been trying to hack Lockheed, General Atomics, Boeing, and another article mentions Raytheon and Airbus. So maybe that's what they mean by the aviation industry.
Yeah, they've been trying for years to hack the drone program. I know that, but you know they've got huge, fending off industry there, just keeping the drone network alive. You know, the military stuff.
Yeah, any computer system administrator will tell you that there are probes and attempts constantly, and it runs the gamut from script kiddies, you know, some kid in their basement that's downloaded a script and just trying to poke around and see where they can get in, all the way up through industrial espionage and of course even governments. And I don't think any government that has the technical ability has not been involved in this kind of thing. I would say our own included, but it puts a lot of pressure on companies. I think sometimes the attitude is, you know, if they're hacked, then it's, you know, somebody has done something really bad and they are the victim. But many times you find that these companies are not implementing just basic security measures that would prevent a lot of these from happening. So it really is kind of an awareness thing, I think. But aviation is certainly vulnerable, as are other industries. And speaking of hacking, and just sort of a final item, talk about GPS. There's an interesting article from AOPA, Keeping Next Gen in the Air. And there was a task group. It was co-chaired by AOPA, and they looked at GPS interference in this case when there are certain military activities being conducted. And they made a number of recommendations about this topic. The government, the military rather, is specifically tasked to test the robustness of systems like this and to be able to deal with them when there's a conflict. And so they run exercises at times, and the GPS system, it's almost like there's a big knob that can be turned that, you could turn the thing off completely, but also can cause specific areas to lose signal, can degrade the signal. You can change the accuracy of the GPS system. All that stuff is controllable. And so the military at times conducts these exercises. So AOPA and the others in this task force made 25 recommendations that are in a report that just came out this month. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. AOPA says this is a must read for aircraft operators who want to understand the knowns, the unknowns, and the future planning designed to make interference events, which tripled in number from 2012 to 2017, non-issues for civil aircraft. It's an interesting read and interesting to contemplate how fragile the GPS system is and, you know, what can happen to pilots when there are problems.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason that we're seeing people at the FAA backing off a little bit on decommissioning all the VORs in this country. Certainly, they are becoming fewer of them. We just had one decommissioned here in the last few months in Northern California. But certainly, given how fragile GPS is, it really does make sense to keep some type of backup system in place.
It really seems that way to me, Max. I mean, if GPS just died one day, for whatever reason, system failure or some malicious act or something. Under Next Gen, what happens? I mean, is there a backup?
Well, Next Gen has so many pieces, many of them which are not related to GPS, but I think you're right. I think there are critical pieces which would then be an issue. We've got all these special descent procedures that are set up to try and save fuel, and they definitely rely on paths that are going to be identified mostly by GPS. So yeah, there are pieces that would be missing.
Yeah, I know that it's really expensive, but I was always wondering why there aren't two GPS systems at this point, one for exclusive for military use and the other for civilian use.
Well, I think originally, you know, it was too expensive to have more than one, but there are other countries that either have them or are developing them, China, the EU, and Russia, and it, remember, it's a passive system, so you are receiving signals into your GPS receiver. You're not sending anything back up to the satellites. You're only receiving. So it really doesn't matter whether you're using U.S. satellites or Chinese satellites or somebody else's. But the receivers that we have are at least the only, you know, the commercially available receivers only. Can only use one of the satellite systems.
Well, and that's actually changing a little bit. Some of the manufacturers of GPS receivers are adding secondary receivers. So, for example, some of them have added GLONASS, which is the Russian system, and that does provide some redundancy. Of course, if you lost both systems, then you'd have a problem, but that seems pretty unlikely. Of course, the other way that you could get around this would be local jamming, for example. So if you had high power signals on the ground within some local area, you could prevent reception of any of these signals from different kinds of systems. So there's still, I think, holes in the system. They're just not completely fail-safe.
Again, we're speaking with Steve Hinton. He's president of Planes of Fame. Steve, again, welcome back to the podcast. It's been, I guess, a couple of years since we've had you on the show. What's new at the museum? Can you give us an update?
Well, new at the museum. Every day is a new day. Yeah, we work throughout the year and with the events. Every month we have a what we call Living History event where we showcase an aircraft and have a forum, guest speaker. We have several hundred people, sometimes 1,000 people come to it. I mean, it's the first Saturday of every month. The next one we have coming up next month is the B-25, and we've got a topic there, Doolittle Raid, and we have a group we've been working with here, Planes of Fame. It's called the 8080 Group, and we're trying to gather 16 B-25s in another 4 years together to working with the Navy and with the Chinese government is even interested in helping in this too to commemorate the Doolittle mission.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been done several times. We haven't really let that out yet too much, but because we're still getting organized. But that'll be one of the active themes for this first Saturday of the month event. Talking about some of the plans that we've been trying to put together.
Now, of course, you also have an annual air show, which this year is, May 5th and 6th?
Yeah, the first weekend of May, yeah. And we're prepping for that, of course, and working all the planes. And yeah, we think we'll have a good one this year. It's, we call it Thunderbolt and Lightning. That's our theme this year. We've got three P-38s here, and we hope to have two P-47s. We've got the A-10 Thunderbolt. It's going to be the, you know, it's back on the demo circuit now, so it's going to come and do the show. And our supporters, you know, we'll have airplanes from the Warhawk Air Museum up in Idaho, and Freak and Family Collection, and Rod Lewis's collection, and a couple of airplanes here and there. And you know, we usually have about 45 different warbirds flying for the show. And Sean Tucker will come this year. We've got Greg Collier in the T-33. Rob Harrison with his Lynn that he does. Well, actually, it's not this Lynn. It's the it's a Czechoslovakian tricycle gear airplane, Tumbling Bear Act. We've got the Riverside Commemorative Air Force paratroopers are going to be here this year, and as well as the normal, we do have a Korean War battle that we do with the Meg and the Saber and all the, you know, the other Korean War type airplanes flying around, and we put that on our speaker system for the crowd. We'll have a Mosquito, the T-6 Mosquito, what they would call as the forward air controller, and he calls in, you know, the troops, so to speak, you know, the air support for the troops that are stuck on the ground in contact with the enemy. And, you know, then the fast-moving bad guy MiG shows up, and then the Hollywood Saber guy shows up and cleans his guys out. So, you know, that's just kind of what we do every year. We have a we feel every year we improve, and we've got a lot of positive feedback every year. So we're hoping that we have good weather and we'll have a successful event.
How long does it take to plan an air show as large as this?
Well, it's like anything else. If we hadn't done it before, you know, the planning would take a lot more than it does. You know, most of this, I won't say most of it, but quite a lot of it is a repetition of the experience and the planning we've been doing, you know, for the last 25 plus years. But it's always something new. We have new issues to deal with all the time. Nothing serious, I should add, though. We just within our group, we have a very dedicated volunteer group, and it's a show must go on. We push hard to try to make it clean and make it nice and make it simple.
Do you use the same announcers each year?
Well, you know, Ed Maloney was our main guy, and of course, you know, Ed passed away a couple years ago, and great man, great information, and a lot of great stories. Kevin Thompson, who worked with Ed all the time, he's our announcer, and then we'll have people help, you know, in addition to, you know, to add some color commentary, so to speak. A lot of what we do is different from other air shows. It's more information instead of, you know, the gee whiz, wow, look at that go by. You know, it's more like here's a P-51D with the, you know, the history of it type of thing. That's what the running commentary usually is from Kevin and Ed. And then we've added, like I mentioned, like for instance, the Korean War scenario, the announcer being in the air at the time, you know, the, we have two military guys that run that show, you know, cause they can talk the talk. The rest of us go duh and yeah, huh? You know, and they have all the right lingo back and forth, you know, but, you know, announcing is a big part of it. We have, Sue Paul from the Warhawk Air Museum come down from Boise, and she helps prior to the actual flying event. You know, we do veteran history kind of interviews and conversations. You know, our veterans, God bless them, you know, they're dwindling. You know, they're not a lot of them left anymore, but they've still got good stories to tell, and Sue can find a way to pull it out from, you know, pull it out.
Now, of course, this takes place at Chino Airport in California. What kind of visitor numbers do you typically run for these annual shows?
Well, you know, we're maxed out with the amount of space we have at the airport, and the airspace is getting, you know, is crowding us out now too. You know, there's so much air traffic around here; it's hard to get a. The FAA works with us very well to get a waiver, but it's hard to get more than we have. We usually have about 30 to 35,000 people for the weekend, but we couldn't handle any more than that at the airport. If the sun is out and the weather's clear, you know, we'll have a really good turnout. And if the, you know, last year and a couple years before, we had some rain and it was kind of scary, but we've never been rained out, and we've always had a show. So we seem to have been very fortunate that way.
And Steve, there were still a lot of people that showed up even in the rain.
That's true. Yeah, you know, it reminds me of another story. My wife Karen and I went, you know, we go to air shows in England all the time. And the first time, this is back in the early 80s, we were with Stephen Gray at an air show, and it's raining, cats and dogs, and we're briefing. And you know, it's like, okay, whatever, you know, we're obviously not going to fly. But I swear, you know, the time came by, and it's still raining, and guys were climbing in. And I said, well, I'll see you later, Karen. I guess we're going. So I jumped in one of the planes, and we flew in the rain. They're used to it there. Here we wouldn't do that, but yes, you know, when people come to see the world's only Japanese Zero fly and to see the world's only Flying Wing fly, you know, there's a lot of people out there sent out there with their umbrellas, and we'll do our very best to make it all happen. You know, that's why we're here.
I actually like two-day air shows where one day has beautiful weather and the other day has kind of crummy weather, because if you go both days, you kind of get two air shows sometimes. You know, you get the high show and you get the low show, and sometimes they're a bit different.
Well, they are different. They're 100% different. Yeah, that's true, especially with the formation teams. You know, we did a show last year in Colorado Springs at the National Museum of World War II Aviation. That's the newly formed group there, Bill Clares and his group there, Colorado Springs. And they have a beautiful ramp, and they have, you know, Colorado Springs Airport, and the Thunderbirds and a bunch of the Warbirds. And it was barely 1,500-foot overcast, and I think the Thunderbird show is just as good with a low show.
Yeah.
I mean, too low to do any aerobatics, but they were ripping around back and forth, you know, lower, and the noise was louder because the clouds kind of kept the noise in. So you're right. Nobody talks about that, but that's really true. There's a different look.
It really is. Yes, yes. I don't know if you're able to talk about this or not, but there was a lawsuit associated with the show. I think some of the other airport tenants or businesses had some issues with the effect on them of the air show. Are you able to talk about how that's worked out?
Well, all I can tell you is that we've worked it out, and we're full speed ahead with the air show this year. So we'll all be doing what we always do, and you know, we're able to work our way through it.
Great, good. Brian, do I understand that Steve did some kind of unique and interesting flying not too long ago? Is that right?
Well, I think Steve gets to do an awful lot of really unique flying all the time. He's so incredibly fortunate. But yeah, I saw on TV that he got to do the flyover at the Super Bowl this year. So it was kind of neat to see your name mentioned there. And I believe you're in a P-51 Mustang, right?
That's right. Yeah, I got the call you know, originally the Thunderbirds were going to do the flyby, but somehow they weren't able to do it. So Air Combat Command, ACC, you know, CAS, the Heritage, put the demo teams together. And I got a call and I said, hey, you know, hey, would you like to fly in the Super Bowl? And I'm thinking, well, sure. Yeah. When, you know, when is it? And so anyway, I hang up the phone, and then I think, wait a minute. Oh, it's in Minneapolis. And oh my gosh, it's February. Oh, hello. you know, it's cold and it's real severe weather, you know, like, well, okay, you know, and so what's next? You know, where do we find a Mustang? And the Museum Wings of the North there at Flying Cloud Airport in Minnesota, they have a beautiful Mustang called Sierra Sue, and their staff, they were willing to let us use that Mustang. It's completely restored back to the original. I mean, it's got the, you know, the guns in it. It's got the fuel tank in the back, and a fabulous looking airplane, fabulous flying airplane too, I might add. But real friendly group up there. You know, we went up there and met everybody. Most of the people up there, I won't say most, but quite a few of them I knew. When Bob Pond, named from the past, famous Warbird collector, since passed away, but when he first started collecting airplanes, he was actually, we called him Planes Fame East is the name he used. And for about 10 or 12 years at Flying Cloud Airport. Got a great collection of airplanes. It's now part of the Palm Springs Air Museum collection now. But quite a few of the people there, they're part of the Wings of the North Museum. We're all Planes of Fame members up there. So it's kind of like old home week after a while, all the faces I hadn't seen in a long time. And they were over the top friendly and accommodating. It's kind of a cool little story. Try to make a short story out of this, but a lot of pressure. For one thing, I fly with the Air Force. I've flown with all the different jets that we perform with. The A-10s, F-16, the F-22, the 35, the 15, 16s, all those airplanes. And every year, every 2 years, they change the demo pilots, and we're always training, and we communicate a lot. The Air Force, through the Heritage Flight organization, it's his foundation. Friedkin family has sponsored that organization for many years, and we keep a pretty cohesive group. There's 9 of us civilians that are trained and qualified to fly with the Air Force at air shows, called the Heritage Flight Foundation. And I've been saying that anyway, there's all procedures we go through. Here, this could be a flyby, and we're going to have the P-51 in the lead. We've got 2 A-10s, one on each wing, and then the F-16 will make the box in the back. It makes the flight of 4. So we brief with the FAA, a lot of pressure the Air Force has never done this before. It's always been the Blue Angels or Thunderbirds, but the Air Combat Command has never done it, the Super Bowl flyover, and it's a pretty high-profile event. So guys, don't screw it up. That's basically it. So we brief on our proposed flight path and timing, and we meet up on over the rendezvous spot with the A-10s and the F-16. I show up on a Friday at the prescribed time, and we only have a waiver for one flyby. So we make our flyby, and so we get our ground references and timing down. The timing is really critical, by the way.
Yeah, sure.
That was Friday. So Saturday, it snowed and rained, and not snowed, but it snowed and froze, which made life interesting. Fortunately, the Mustang I was flying was in a very well-maintained hangar, and we had about 20 people around all the time, so I basically, 3 pairs of long underwear and gloves and a jacket. And, so I was pretty cozy in the airplane. Then I'd sit in it, get ready to go. They'd open the doors, get me outside, and then off I'd go. But so come Sunday morning, we have our briefing at 10 a.m. And there's the, with the Air Force and the demo pilots and the FAA and the NFL and NBC and whoever, they're all there during this briefing. And say, okay, Steve, we need you over the target at 17:21 and 43 seconds. So I'm thinking, 17:20, what does that mean? Oh, my God, 5:21 and 43 seconds. She goes, yeah, Pink's song is 2 minutes and 4 seconds long. And, our colonel who's in charge of our activities is there, and he's briefing us all. And so while he's briefing and talking, my mind's going, oh, boy, how are we going to do this? Now it sounds easy, doesn't it? But the way we basically did it is we go to a hold position. We held north of the big airport there in Minneapolis, and in a figure eight kind of pattern. It turned out we had like a 30 knot crosswind too. So it was 10 seconds into the wind before the turnaround and 5 seconds downwind from the turnaround. So we kind of get in a groove for about 20 minutes there, so we're just kind of, I'm in this figure eight groove and, time hack as we count down. So I've got an idea of when I'm going to make my turn in and everything too. No pressure. We got the 75-year-old airplane leading, the guys with all the equipment are behind me following. And Steve, don't make a mistake, right? And now we're down to 2 minutes till the run-in time, so the 2 minute and 4 second hack, right? So he goes, okay, give you a 2 minute hack. And then, so I'm starting my turnaround because, like I say, I've already timed these figure eights, so I'd have enough to cheat either plus or minus a little bit as I turn in. And they say, okay, Heritage Flight, got to add 56 seconds.
Oh, no.
Oh, great. So I get my pen out, the right, and, I learned something on that flight. Ballpoint pens don't work when it's that cold. And so So now I'm doing it in my head, and then I missed my checkpoint, you know, where my turn point was. And then halfway through the turn, where I'm now making a really big guess, they said, yeah, they had another 23 seconds. It's like, okay, here we go. And the only thing that had numbers on it was the transponder. So I just dialed up some numbers there, that in addition that I made in my head to try to get it. But what really saved me is I had four flight on my Ram X mount to the, and I had, we'd go to street map, you know, the stadium I put as the waypoint. So after I made about two or three guesses about turning, you know, if I go right directly to it, you know, it gives me a time to that spot. So, okay, I got that. Okay, and I'm too fast, so I had to, so I made a, instead of a direct, I made a, like an angle turn away and then back at it. Long story short, just by the stroke of luck, that we actually got there, like 1 second early, I think. So,
oh, wow. That's amazing.
So yeah, it worked out really well. And, we were all heroes in our own mind. And, she came off, it looked, you know, if you watch on TV, it was like, she sang the song and it looked up, there we were. And, but for all the gears to grind and work at the same time, you know, the A-10s were from Tucson and the, F-16 was from, Carolina, South Carolina. And, the crew that, service those airplanes on the cold ramp, and you just think of everything happening to make that happen. I'm just glad to be part of it. It was a pretty exciting time, and I can chuckle about it now.
Yeah, well
done.
So,
Steve, I know that it was difficult for you doing all those calculations and getting to where you needed to be on time. How hard was it for the other guys flying, because they were in so much more of a performant aircraft than what you were in? So
the issue they have, they can add 200 or 300 knots in a hurry if they needed to, or, you know, they have the equipment to do it, but they're following me. And also, they have UHF radios and they have better communications with the ground. Our ground communications to me were not that great. You know, because we have civilian radios that don't have the capability they do. And, you know, we were all, three of us conversing, you know, or four of us in our flight conversing about what was going on. And, everybody had an opinion, you know, of what we should do. But, like I say, it worked out.
You know, Steve, I'd like to ask you something, since we're talking about military airplanes here. What is it that you think, when it comes to warbirds, what is it that seems to fascinate people so much of all ages when they see these old airplanes? And they're not all super old, but most of them.
Well, yeah, I use this term as my own dub term. I call it the cool factor. You know, I mean, some airplanes sound beautiful. Some airplanes look beautiful. Some airplanes are fast. Some are just unique, you know, and just, yeah, you know, everybody's going to have their favorite airplane and how they move, and, you know, what they look like. And I just think it's mainly the noise and the thunder, really, that, you know, it's like going to the Reno Air Races, the trophy race versus the, you know, the unlimited race. I mean, that's stuff you know, you remember your whole life, the noises and the speed at which planes go by, the beauty of a, you know, airplane doing a maneuver. You know, there's just a lot of reasons, but it's just all cool stuff.
Good point.
Steve, when you consider a warbird like the P-51, there are certainly a number of them out there, maybe restored to various degrees, but I'll ask a stupid non-pilot question. How much variability is there from one to the next? I mean, if you're in one P-51 and then you hop in the cockpit of another P-51, is there any real difference from a piloting standpoint, or are they all just the same?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. But I've flown, I think, about 54 different Mustangs, and I bet you not too many of them fly the same. They all fly the same. They all, you know, take off and land and cruise and climb. But a good friend of mine, Skip Holm, coined the phrase a long time ago, Mustang's a good name. They're like a horse, you know. Hmm. Every horse is different. And they really are. Some you fly, like one of the Mustangs we have here at the museum, we put together like 33 or 34 years ago. And it's made of crash parts. I mean, everything we got on that thing was damaged, had to repair it. This is one of the best flying Mustangs I've ever flown. Hmm. The other Mustang we have at the museum called Spam Can, you know, Mr. Maloney got that from, bought it from the Air Force in 1959, $1,500, by the way. And it's been the same exact airplane. It's the same parts it was manufactured with. It wasn't a combat plane or anything like that. And it flies great, but it's not fast. You know, I mean, there are just so many. We've built more than 10 of them right here in our shop. And some are just unique, and they're special in the way they feel. And some of them are like a tank. I mean, I've flown some. They're gorgeous, beautiful airplanes that are just detailed to the nth degree, you know, and you think, oh my God, and you fly and you go, geez, what a truck, you know. And it is funny, you know. I guess it's kind of a curse sometimes too when you get to fly a lot of different airplanes, because if you didn't know, you know, this thing could fly a lot better. You know, Bob Hoover, whenever he borrowed somebody's Mustang for an event, he'd always come back and tell the owner, man, that's the finest Mustang you've ever flown. And then he'd look over me and he'd wink or something, you know. It's But they're all great. You know, they all are unique in their own way, but they are great.
You mentioned the Air Force Heritage Flight Foundation, and that's a nonprofit organization, but many of our listeners might not be real familiar with that organization and just exactly what it does and how it does it. Can you tell us a little bit about the foundation?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a foundation. Let's start back 20 years ago when the original Heritage Flight was put together by the Air Force, and the Air Force had a budget for it. And the Air Force, most everybody in the organization owned an airplane or had access to an airplane. And we were able to support, you know, for, gosh, 15 years about, we were able to, you know, with the Air Force budget, we were able to support, you know, the air show events. And it was usually like 50 to 60 air shows a year. I'm pretty sure something like that. I used to do 5, 6, 7 a year every year, and sometimes even more, you know, some out here. And a lot of times we had airplanes out at certain places. You know, we would schedule air show tour around that, you know. But then, you know, the budget started drying up, and one of the new pilots in our group, he and his father put together this foundation to support this, to keep this alive. You know, it's all about supporting our the memory of the past and giving recognition to the people that sacrificed, that served today. You know, it's really, I don't know if you guys have ever been to it, but even as a spectator, you know, if you witness it, it's really pretty well, you know, a good display with the airplanes flying together, you know, the music, and it usually follows the demonstration of the, you know, the fighter that does the demo, and then we'll join up with the airplane. We use a P-51 or a P-47 or a P-40 or a P-38, the Sky Raider, or my favorite, the F-86, you know. So those are the airplanes that the Air Force, you know, has approved, and those are the planes we use. But the foundation was put together to keep it alive, you know, keep this, you know, it is such a remarkable thing, a tribute to, you know, the United States Air Force.
The foundation accepts donations from, from anyone, individuals as well as corporate donations. How is that money used?
The donations mainly come from, you know, they fund the foundation mostly themselves. There is some money donated here and there, but I don't know that. You know, I can't be quoted on that, to tell you the truth. But through their own companies, their own means, they fund that foundation. That's how strong they believe in it. And the money's used to pay for the airplanes. You know, the foundation owns several of the airplanes that gets used. When they use one of our planes, you know, then we have an agreed amount of money to try to help cover the cost of flying it. You know, some of the shows we fly are, you know, 1,000 miles from here. You know, it's pretty expensive to fly a P-51 or an F-86 on a long distance, you know, to participate in that. So, you know, there's a lot of expense involved. The pilots, we're all volunteers. We don't get paid to do it. We don't ask to be paid to do it. It's a privilege to be part of it.
Tell us, Steve, where folks can learn more about Planes of Fame online, and also if there's anything else that's going on in your life that you want to share with us.
Oh, sure. But Planes of Fame, the name planesoffame.org. We have a website, and it keeps up to date of our activities and, you know, what goes on at the museum. Pretty good at keeping it current. And the HeritageFlightFoundation.org is another one. You could follow up on that if you want, or Air Combat Command ACC, you know, .AF, .MIL, whatever, however that works out. You can Google that. And we've got a lot of things going on in the museum all the time. Restorations going, undergoing. We've got, once in a while we do a movie job, so we're working on planes. We've recently kind of spent some more time on getting some of the smaller airplanes flying. We've just recently got the L-4 flying. We've got an Aircoop flying. We have a PT-26 back in Atlanta that we've got to bring home. There's besides the normal warbirds, we got air shows last weekend. We were at weekend before at El Centro. We had the SBD, the TBM, the B-25, the P-51A, the P-38, the F-86, and the MiG-15. We all up there at El Centro. And then last weekend, I had the F-86 at Yuma and got to fly with the F-22, a heritage flight. So.
Wow.
This coming weekend, we'll be at the L.A. County Air Show at Fox Field. So we've got, what's going to that? The Corsair, the B-25, our P-38, as well as Collins Foundation 38 is going to go to that. And then we got the Sabre and the MiG. And, so we'll be busy this weekend. We've got a movie job that is materializing right now. We might take one of our planes over to England, or over to Europe, I should say, this summer. We're always prepping for something going on. And then, here at Fighter Rebuilders, which is a part of the museum display here, we're building, rebuilding a Constellation.
Ah.
And we're rebuilding and a Hawker Sea Fury and a Grumman Bearcat and a P-51 Mustang. And so, part of the museum's display has always been, for the last 30 years, 35 years, has been Fighter Rebuilders here. And, we've, by design, within the museum property, we lease separately and we're a separate business, but we restore airplanes for the museum as well as customers. And, unlike a lot of museums, you visit them once and you visit them twice, they're the same thing all the time. But because of the active business that we have going on here, Planes of Fame, there's always something new going on. We're always, we've got 2 weeks ago, John Maloney, for instance, we had a museum project to use our Swirsky P-35 in a new watch commercial. So, we rarely fly that airplane. No, we just fly it occasionally, I should say. So here's a chance, took it out and put about 10 hours on the thing. And it's great to see that thing roaring around. We just hung a new engine on the B-25. We were rebuilding the Stearman in the corner. We've got the Bell P-59, which is America's first jet. Been an ongoing volunteer restoration at Planes of Fame, and it's been constantly got going. We've got a new Navy on. We just spent about 15 years of our volunteers rebuilding, and it just is recently flying. We've got a C-47 that we've been able to finally find the wing attach angles, so we've got our crew on those doing putting the new angles on the wings. It goes on and on. It's you got to run to keep up with everybody around here. We've got a really, really, really great crew, and a lot of enthusiasm, and when the sun shines, then the museum shines.
Wow.
And Steve, I think that's really one of the things about the museum. You say it goes on, and it really does. The very first time I was out there, I was just amazed over how many hangars you guys occupy. And just when you think you've seen it all, you go beyond another door, and there's this whole other hangar that's opened up, and then there are the outdoor displays, and you didn't even talk about the library and the tens of thousands of books that you guys have in the library. I am always amazed every time I go there, and I end up seeing something else that I never saw before. It truly is an amazing place to me.
Yeah, it's quite a tribute to Ed Maloney. He was our hero, all these years. Even we were frustrated when I say I've been around since I was 7 years old. I've been a part of this museum. I've been president of the museum for 24 years now, I think, something like that, maybe longer. But, every once in a while you get frustrated because, you might not agree with some of the things Ed was doing. But, my gosh, looking back at it, he was truly a visionary. He was an amazing person, and we really miss him. But he's left a great legacy behind. Just the can-do attitude. Ed was always very positive about things, and let's just find a way to do it. That's the way we operate. Hmm.
Well, Steve, it's so important to keep this history alive and flying, and I think we all are really appreciative of the work that you and the whole crew are doing to make that possible. It's just fantastic. God's work, I guess.
Well, yeah, it is. it's not like work either. Let's put it that way. You know, that's another thing when you, you know, that same old story, when you like what you do, you never work a day in your life. And the only thing I ever regret is that there's only 7 days in the week. You know, it's really, because there's so much stuff we have piled up that we want to do. And, you know, we operate at the speed that we have operating capital at, and or, you know, just to get things done. There are some projects that would go faster if we had a little more money on it, but then there's other things that we fill in, you know, so there's never a loss for things to do. We're constantly, you know, the latest big project that that we're working on internally is, you know, the future of the museum, you know, where are we going over the next 20 or 30 years? And we're very happy with where we are here at Chino, but we're also looking at possibly open up in another location. So we've been spending time researching that and seeing what possibility might be.
Yeah, fantastic.
Hey, I have a question for you. Just one quickie.
Sure.
Now, you get airplanes from so many different places, but I'm just curious if you guys were kind of drooling a little bit when Paul Allen's group found the Lexington out there in the waters near Australia a couple of weeks ago, and they said they've probably located at least, I think, 15 or 18 of the airplanes that were on the Lexington?
Well, you know, the possibilities are endless. And if you're Paul Allen and have his means, then yeah.
I mean, he doesn't just give you one?
not hardly. And plus, I don't know if that would even be in the cards to pull anything up, really. I mean, that's a grave site. That's a monument in itself.
Yeah, that's a good point.
12,000 feet down, for crying out loud. You know, so there, although, you know what, I would be surprised if they don't pull at least a Devastator up, because there are no Devastators anywhere on the planet. You know what I'm saying? That would be, I'm sure the Navy would, or probably already salivating over that thing, trying to figure out how to get, you know, the one picture I saw looked like it was a pretty complete airplane. Especially at that depth, it may not be as bad. Well, it won't be as bad as it would have been if it was a shallower depth.
Is that because lower oxygen levels down low, so you wouldn't have as much corrosion?
Apparently, yes. Yeah, and you don't have as much growth, you know, from animal life down there.
Not much life.
There is animal life, but nothing like it's black down there, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's done quite good too, Paul Allen. That's another for your viewers and listeners. I mean, that's worth going to visit there at Payne Field. He's got a nice collection he's put together, and most recently we added the Mosquito to the collection last year. It was completed in New Zealand, and I work with those guys up there too, and do a lot of flying up there with them, and so we flew the Mosquito for the first time last summer, and now it's part of the fleet there. So if anybody would like to see a Mosquito fly, that's the only place you're going to see one on the you know, west of Virginia Beach, Florida. Virginia Beach, Virginia, rather, I should say. So they're just
okay. Here's one last question: How many museums? I grant you, yours is the best aviation museum, but looking at all those other ones that are out there, how many? Any idea how many aviation museums that look at warbirds really exist?
Well, I don't have a number, but there's quite a few, and there's some really nice ones too. You know, never say never. I mean, there's some beautiful collections of planes, and there's some amazing people have some amazing airplanes that don't even have on display either. I mean, we've got some very close friends that have 30 warbirds that are world-class warbirds, but they're not on display. There's a lot of stuff out there that have come the last 10, 15 years, you know. Back in when I first started, you know, flying these airplanes, for instance, a Mustang, you know, it was like a $25,000 airplane. And one propeller blade on a Mustang right now is about $25,000. So, but once they kind of reached a level at that time, you know, doctors and lawyers could afford them, and guys in construction, and, you know, just guys who made a nice living. But now once these collectors got involved, my gosh, the price went up, and there used to be a lot of, you know, wrecks laying around, but now it's worth to restore these wrecks. So, you know, at one time someone came up with a number of 200 and some aviation museums across the United States, but I bet there's more than that. just in California alone, there's two on this airport, and then there's probably five or six. But, you know, there are very few that have a large collection of planes, like Planes of Fame, for instance. But there's always a museum, you know, that you'd be surprised some never hear of. And you say, hey, you go to the museum of, you know, Boise, Idaho. I go, yeah, I know those guys. Well, I didn't know they existed, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty exciting.
Great enthusiasm, too. There's a lot of really great people, you know, that are turned on and, you know, really saving the stories.
Yep.
Hey, Max West, are you jealous? I mean, I am.
Oh, absolutely. It would be fun to be closer in Southern California. I have been to the museum there one time, and, you know, I think Brian's comment about the library was, you know, spot on. I remember just looking at all the stuff on the walls and reading, and oh, the stories of the past are fascinating.
Hey, Steve, do you guys ever adopt pilots?
Yeah, but let me tell you how the adoption process works. Let me tell you, you gotta start. It's like spider webs and brooms. And you just kind of work your way up. There's no promises here. If you're a normal guy and you work hard and you're part of the crew and you're an asset, and, you know, there you go. We can add you to the fleet. I bet you there's probably 15 different guys in our group that fly the airplanes. There's only a couple of us that fly all of them, though. John Maloney and myself are really the only two that fly everything. But, you know, we're open doors.
Yeah, well, you probably lost us at normal.
Yeah, you blew it at the normal part, right? Yeah. We got a lot of. We have airline pilots. We have fire bomber pilots. We have, you know, guys that are our volunteers that work here too, and we have other warbird collector friends that are part of the museum. But we sure don't put an application out, you know, or advertise. But we've had really good luck, not just luck though. But we've got a really good attitude and a self-policing attitude here too. You know, everybody is. We treat this stuff like we own it. You know, it's instead of dog loves a fire hydrant too. You know what I'm saying? And some people treat airplanes that way, but we don't. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Steve, it's been a great conversation. We really want to thank you for coming back on the show and talking with us and our audience.
You're welcome. Anytime you're bored and you need somebody to babble for 15 minutes, you know, give me a call.
All right. We appreciate it. And, of course, the website is planesoffame.org. We'll have that in the other sites that we mentioned in the show notes. So look for those there. And
please do. Yeah. And it's all good stuff.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah. We need to remind everyone to come out for the air show.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, come out to our show and, you know, and then love our veterans too. You know, it's just take time to shake their hand if you ever see guys around, you know what they did. There's so many great stories out there. And you start talking, you can see that 90-year-old guy turn into a 17-year-old sometimes. You know?
Yes.
You know, we're good friends with Bud Anderson, and we get him talking, and you could just see the look on his face right there when he starts talking about, like being a test pilot at Edwards and some experiences, learning how to fly, and of course combat and things. He's got, you know, he's got unique experiences that, you know, the people that can only dream about. So we're just lucky to have these guys around, and cherish it while you can.
Cool. All right. Thanks again, Steve.
Thanks for doing this, Steve.
You're welcome, Max, Brian, and Rob, and we'll catch up.
Interesting guy. Interesting life.
Yeah, he was on episode 386, I forgot to mention earlier.
Yeah. All right, Brian, you found an interesting, story of the week for us. Would you come up with this time?
Yeah, since there wasn't really any positive aviation or commercial aviation news this week, I came across something really neat that Pratt & Whitney was doing or is doing. And it certainly goes along with how women have contributed to the aviation industry. And they're coming out with a book entitled Powering the Eagle, Over 90 Years and Counting, Pratt & Whitney's Inspirational Women. And I think this goes along really nicely with the book. And we talked about the other book on the show, Trailblazers, Women of the Boeing Company. And I just think that it's really important for us to mention the great valuable contributions that women have made to aviation. And I think that it's fantastic that Pratt & Whitney is taking the time and effort and company resources and helping to contribute to the book, recognizing what the women have done for the over 90 years of working at Pratt.
Yeah, very cool. I didn't know about this. I do see from this article we'll have, this is actually from the Runway Girl Network. It says that, or it notes that Marianne Cannon, the vice president who spearheaded this effort, of course, I'd known her for years. A great lady, cool person, really interesting and really smart lady. She'd make a great guest. Maybe we can get Marianne on the show sometime. But it was kind of fun to see, you know, a few names in here of people I've known from my past employment. So we'll have a link to the Runway Girl article in the show notes. Look for it there.
Yeah, and hopefully a book like this could inspire other young women to get into the STEM or STEAM programs and get interested in aviation and really pursue their passion.
Yes.
And Max, I know that the eagle is part of the Pratt & Whitney logo, hence powering the eagle. Does it have any other meaning beyond that?
It's just used as shorthand for the company. People that have been there for a while will call Pratt & Whitney the eagle, refer to it as the eagle. That's it. It's from the logo. All right. A little bit of what's up with the geeks. Let's see. Aviation-wise, Rob, got anything interesting going on?
Well, this week, towards the end of the week, I'm headed down to the same state that Max T is headed for, beautiful Georgia. I'm going down to Savannah to go get a little stick time in Gulfstream's new G500 that was just about ready to make the rounds for those new buyers. So I'm going to be real nice fly-by-wire biz jet, and I'll be really excited to talk about that when I get back.
Cool. Very nice. Max West, what are you up to?
Well, I've had just been trying to stay alive here. I've had two close encounters with aircraft in the last 2 weeks. It's just starting to get to me a little bit.
Yikes.
Yeah, I know. I talked about one in the episode last week of Aviation News Talk where I was in a Cirrus. What the pilot was doing a touch and go off of the left runway, and there was a pilot taking off from the right runway. Now, that pilot had gotten my attention because as we were on final, I heard him say, "I overshot the runway. I'm turning back around to get to it to take off." And I thought, boy, this is not a pilot that's very savvy. If he, you know, he taxied across the runway he was supposed to take off on and now has to turn around to get back to that runway. So I was watching him. Later found out that he was a student pilot. But as we were both on the upwind, we were just about 100 feet below him or less, and he was a couple hundred feet in front of us, and he suddenly made a hard left turn right in front of us, which got my attention. Of course, I'd been watching him continually because I expected, you know, maybe he might start to drift over into our lane or something like that, but I certainly didn't expect that kind of maneuver. So we've had long discussion with the tower manager about that, and there are going to be some changes to procedures at that airport. So the I think the issue was that they were been used to in the past just accepting requests from pilots to turn to, you know, depart to the east, depart to the north, and this pilot said he was going to depart to the east, which was virtually runway heading, but instead went to the north, so he didn't know his compass headings very well. And in the future, they're going to request that pilots say whether or not they're going to do a straight out or do a left crosswind departure, which will make it a lot less ambiguous. So that was one close encounter. And then today I was at Half Moon Bay, a non-towered airport. We were in the pattern. And as we were on the crosswind, there was an aircraft that was coming to join the pattern on the 45. He said he had us in sight. And I said, "Oh, are you following us?" And he said, "Yes." And as we turned to downwind, he looked like he formed up us on the right wing in formation. He was probably less than 100 feet off my right wing and ever so slightly behind me. And then what was remarkable, it looked like he, you know, was in traffic changing lanes. He suddenly whooped to the left and disappeared behind me as if he were, you know, rapidly switching lanes. So I said to him, "Gee, you know, we might not have been so close if you were to fly a wider downwind." And he acknowledged that, yeah, if he had flown a wider downwind, that might kept us further apart. But anyway, I'm just trying to stay alive out here these days. And so for comic relief next week, I'm taking a Cirrus from the Sacramento, California area down to Macon, Georgia. And I'm looking forward to those wide open spaces as I fly across the country.
Yeah, good. Now, do those kind of things get reported?
Oh, both of them did. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is a reporting procedure for NMACs, near midair collisions. So that's what I reported for the tower. Now, for the non-towered airport today, I recognize the call sign of the airplane. It turns out it's from the same club that I'm in, which has about 48 airplanes, and that pilot will be contacted by our safety office.
Okay.
Hey, Mick, can I interrupt with a quick question? Max T, when you, the first incident I was listening to on your show, when the student departed the right runway and basically cut you off on the left, did the tower mention to that pilot that there was traffic departing the parallel runway or anything like that?
No, the tower made no comments. I actually made two comments on the air before the tower basically kind of jumped in, and they still did not contact the student pilot who had turned right in front of me. And I finally said, what were his instructions? And they said he was to depart to the east. Now, the runway heading was 110, so east would have been 20 degrees off of a runway heading. He instead made a 90-degree turn left, which would have put him roughly on a heading of 020 or virtually north.
Yeah, but that makes no sense at all that a controller that was on top of their game wouldn't have said, and by the way, just to keep you in the loop, there's an airplane coming off the left runway there, you know, whatever, just to give the person a heads up. That's crazy. Well, I'm glad you're in one piece.
Well, it was apparent that there was training going on because even before that incident happened, I could hear the voice in the background telling the controller what to say. So I think that there was distractions with that. It seemed apparent to me that they were not watching us when we were on the upwind because I made two radio calls before they seemed to even be aware that there was any kind of problem.
Oh, wow. That's scary.
But I won't mention the airport, Stockton.
Okay. Okay, we won't.
I'm glad you didn't say that.
Yeah, I didn't say it.
Brian, any new adventures aviation-wise from you?
Well, not so much new, but over the weekend, I went back to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and got to hang out with Air Force One. And I really wish David was on the show tonight and he could have commented a little bit, I think, on the history of Air Force One. It's certainly beautiful aircraft, and they keep it in really nice condition. In addition to Air Force One, they also have a version of Marine One at the library as well. So they built a hangar for the aircraft. So people that haven't been out to Simi Valley, California, and have gone to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, it's kind of a fun place to hang out for a bit and see an aircraft.
And where is that located? What town is that in?
So it's Simi Valley, and Simi Valley is a northwestern suburb of Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
So probably, and when I say suburb, it's about, I don't know, an hour and a half from LAX or an hour from downtown LA, but yeah, suburb.
So you, here in Connecticut, if you drive an hour and a half, you're not going to be in the suburb. You're going to be in a different state.
Yeah, Los Angeles is big.
I guess so. All right. Speaking of big, Launchpad Marzari, our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, has been really busy speaking with some interesting people. And right now we're going to listen to his conversation with Ken Viard of Pilot Partner. We had Ken on the show back in, well, I had to look it up, December 2016. It hardly seems like it was that long ago. So let's listen to Launchpad and Ken.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and today I'm here with
Ken Viard, president and founder of Pilot Partner Electronic Pilot Logbook.
Okay, and you're kind of on a mission to get paper out of the cockpit.
In general aviation, we have done such a great job getting a lot of the paper out of the cockpit so far. With electronic flight bags, we've removed all the sectionals and IFR charts and approach plates. But there's one piece of paper we've failed to get out of the cockpit, and that's the dispatch log. If you're flying with a flight club, a partnership, or a flying school, the first thing you do when you get in the airplane is open up that binder and write down your Hobbs and tack start time. And then after you fly, you have to write down your Hobbs and tack end time. And then eventually, maybe months later, someone comes out to the airplane, gets that piece of paper, and magically converts it into an invoice. And that's usually with a lot of stress of trying to read your handwriting and all the text to try to make things match up. So what I'm working on is how to get that out of the air.
So now when I land, I'm filling out my digital logbook, close down that app, bring up my digital dispatch app, and fill it out.
So we make that a lot more easier for you than that. So when you open up Pilot Partner to log your flight, if you are participating in this program with us, that airplane will automatically be tagged to collect that information as a part of your flight. And as an added bonus, how many times have you been in the airplane and you have to get your hob start and your hobs end, and you have to do that simple math problem, which just seems all too complicated because there's a decimal point? We do that math for you. Your total time is automatically calculated based upon the numbers you type in. So as a pilot, you don't even have to do that simple math anymore.
So I'm just doing one entry in my logbook, and it's automatically filling out the dispatch.
Correct. Your logbook entry calculates your total time, automatically gets credited to the dispatch app, and updates all your maintenance records, so now you know accurately to the minute how many hours you have left before your next oil change, before your next 100-hour inspection, or any other time-based inspections that your airplane needs.
Now, if I'm at a club or rental and I put fuel in, has it got a place for me to put fuel?
Absolutely. Every paper dispatch that I've seen in different flying clubs and flight schools have additional columns for custom information. Pilot Partner allows each flying club to customize their extra fields that they want, and you can select from a defined list of items, and these are items that you get to choose and control, or open fields that allow you to enter numbers or text.
All right. So then as the flying club renter, if I'm a Pilot Partner, that automatically can be imported to become a, if I'm a rental agency or the flying club, I can import that information and that automatically generates my invoice.
That is correct. All this information will export into an Excel spreadsheet via a format called CSV. And all these custom fields, all the numbers and the pilot name that is associated with each flight will come in that sheet. Then all you have to do is import that into any common program like QuickBooks or any invoicing system that you have. It will save hours and hours of time trying to generate invoices.
Okay, as a pilot, I'm getting confused, though, is that I'm used to that instructor physically signing my logbook.
So in today's day and age, you no longer need that physical signature. So on a per-flight basis or for your specific endorsements, Pilot Partner allows the flight instructor to both sign with their finger and collect a digital signature and a digital certificate for that signature. Especially if your CFI participates using this Pilot Partner CFI dashboard, they can simply sign by entering their 4-digit PIN code. And all of the endorsements that you're going to need, we have a preloaded database of all the templates, starting with the private pilot all the way up through your advanced ratings, including your multi-engine, instrument, commercial check rides. All those endorsements are preloaded, and your instructor can tweak it as they need to, but and then apply their signature to it. And now it's stored electronically and available to present to the FAA when you do your check ride or you go to your airline interview.
Okay, and when I'm going to an interview, or for some reason the FAA comes down with me, I can just hit print on this, right?
Exactly. With Pilot Partner, you keep everything electronically, and then when you need to share it with somebody, you generate a PDF document, which will print in the exact same format as a Jeppesen Professional Pilot Logbook will.
Cool. You have any final thoughts for our listeners?
The day and age of paper in the cockpit and the fire hazard that paper creates is behind us. And that last piece of paper, that dispatch log, it surprised me how long that stuck around. And now we're ready to get rid of it. The person who's going to love this the most is the person who has to generate the invoices and drive out to the airport on a bad weather day when they weren't going to go flying and they're upset already. Now they can pull this anytime they want and actually invoice more frequently than they currently do because it's going to be that much easier. And we're also very excited to offer all the Airplane Geeks listeners a promo code that is good to give you a 18-month subscription for the price of 12 months, which is $29.95. So you get 18 months instead of 12 months. All you have to do is when you purchase your subscription, use the promo code AirplaneGeeks18. That's the numbers 1-8. So AirplaneGeeks18 will get you 18 months for the price of 12.
Well, there you have it, listeners. Something worth your effort. This is Launchpad Marzari, your reporter at large. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Oh, thank you, Launchpad. Thanks for that update with Pilot Partner, and thanks, Ken, for the promo code. That's a nice gesture. We have a couple of other conversations that Launchpad recorded when he was at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, and we'll have those for you next week. A little bit of listener mail. We heard from Aaron, and he's actually been a listener since episode one. So, wow, that's amazing. Thanks, Aaron. He said he just listened to episode 493. That's with Charlene Fontaine, the founder and executive director of the Flying Tigers 69th DRS Association. He says, and thought you'd appreciate this. A game recently came out for Xbox One and PCs called Flying Tigers Shadows Over China. The main campaign is only about 4 hours long, but it gives a surprisingly accurate historical record of battles from 1941 to 1943 in the CBI, and focuses not only on the AVG, but also the RAF, the IAF, Royal New Zealand Air Force. There's even an aircraft I'd never heard of before, he says, the Vickers Wildebeest. So he says pilots looking for a flight simulator experience will be disappointed because this game has a very arcade-style flight model, featuring unlimited ammo and bullet-time combat skills. However, he says it's an exciting, accessible game. And then in closing, in the interest of full disclosure and shameless self-promotion, I enjoyed the game so much that I'm doing a aircraft history and mission historical connections on my blog. And you can find that at sticksstoriesscotch.blogspot.com. So thanks, Aaron. And further on the topic of shark's teeth on airplanes, Finger Trouble wrote in our Slack listener team, included a photo that's kind of hysterical, I guess. It's a short SC-7 sky van. Now, they operate in Europe for skydiving activities. He says they're usually an orange or pink. The company is named Pink Sky Van. But when they had a contract with the German military for providing paradropping, the army said these planes are too colorful, so they ended up with this particular paint job. So you've got to take a look at the show notes to see this at airplanegeeks.com/495. And then a correction. This came in from Laertes. This is in regard to the conversation we were having about the Trent 1000 engines and the damaged turbine blades. Remember, Brian, we were looking at that photo, and Brian, you'd asked if about the repair process, and and I made a, well, I guess I had a senior moment, and I started talking about integrally bladed rotors, or as Laertes mentions, they're also called blisks, but they don't use that in the turbine. Those are only in the compressor. And of course, we were looking at the turbine. So good catch. I guess I should have known better. But
our listeners keeping us honest.
They are. Chalk that up to a senior moment. And then we heard from our friend David in Augusta, who wrote and said, hey, guys, I listened to the same podcast as your dissenter voting with his wallet and have no idea what he could be upset about. This was in reference to us getting slightly political in a conversation. But anyway, David says, this is just a guess, but maybe people who watch too much faux news, and that's FAUX, capital F and news, capital N. You can figure out what that's a reference to.
Too many, maybe people who watch too much faux news have trouble with factual discourse. Overall, I believe you guys do a good job being politically neutral. Thank you. And then he also says, as for that episode, I thought the outtake banter was the best part of the episode. Hilarious. Yeah, sometimes, well, there's a rule that I in podcasting that I learned really early on, which is once you press record, don't stop it until everybody has hung up the call, because you never know what you're going to get. And so sometimes the outtakes are conversation that happens after we're, quote, done. Other times they're sort of plucked out of the actual recording. But we try to keep those interesting and valuable, if not funny, where we can. So I don't know if we'll have any of that whatsoever for this episode. You never know till it's cooked.
So is David trying to tell us perhaps that the outtakes ought to be the show and we ought to take the show and put that in the outtakes? If the outtakes are the best part, maybe they should come first.
I have run across some listeners who start with the back end and look for the outtakes and listen to those first and then go up to the start of the show.
That is funny. I had not heard that.
Yeah.
Well, I had an email conversation with a person that started the original comment on this, and I think our point still holds true in that I've yet to find any qualifications for the guy that President Trump put forth as was rumored to want to put forth as a nominee for the FAA. And I asked the listener to, let me know what he's found that thinks that Trump's pilot is qualified for, and I've yet to hear back. So I think that this is, I don't know. I don't think we were very political in this case. I think we've still made our case that there was no qualifications put forth, and there still aren't any qualifications, and the listener certainly hasn't provided any qualifications. So until somebody can prove that he is qualified to run the FAA, I think we can stand by our comments that he's not qualified.
Because we just don't have the information.
Yeah.
Nor does anyone else, apparently.
Anyone else, apparently. Yeah. But, so I would love to see the information where he's qualified.
All right. Well, pending our receipt of that, we're going to wrap this one up. Our guest was Steve Hinton, president of Planes of Fame. Find that at planesoffame.org. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com, as always. Look for the show notes for this episode. You can get to those directly at airplanegeeks.com/495. There's usually a lot of good information, a lot of supporting information, photos, pictures, links, videos, things like that. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Brian Coleman, how do we get in touch with you?
The best place to get a hold of me is send an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com. It might take me a few days to get back to it, but I do indeed read every email, and I respond whenever I can. So please send emails away.
All right. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, this time next week, you can find me in November 121 Yankee Zulu. So go to FlightAware and you'll find where we are somewhere across the country as I head off to Georgia in that aircraft. And the other place to find me is out there making podcasts at aviationnewstalk.com.
And Rob Mark, where are you online?
Any place that has Jetwine in the name, and of course, anything that has Flying Magazine in the name.
Cool. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me in LinkedIn with David Vanderhoof each week at the UAVDigest.com and with Mary Kirby over at PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. And please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.